Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The kind of compulsion to write just snuck back in. All my upper mind was forbidding it and thinking that, you know, only being George Eliot or T.H. Lawrence was worth it. But it just persisted.
Hello, writers. Welcome back to Write Off, the podcast about writing rejection in all its forms, from self-doubt to books not selling. I'm your host, Francesca Steele, a journalist and writer based in London. And if you want to know more about my own experience with writing rejection, you can hear about that in the first season. If you want to write domestic fiction, I cannot recommend reading Tessa Hadley, or indeed listening to her here, enough. Tessa, who has been longlisted twice for what is now the Women's Prize, and who the Washington Post called one of the greatest stylists alive, wrote 4 failed novels throughout her 30s and was finally published age 46 with Accidents in the Home. She has now written 8 novels and is one of the modern masters of domestic fiction, burrowing into the complex inner lives of middle-aged women and the clashes between them, their feelings, and the outer world. They are books of enormous sensitivity, but also, as Tessa says here, born of a lot of control and labour. And while Tessa is clear about how compelled she is to write, she is also keen to dispel the idea that it is in any way easy. "I'm a slow and painful writer, writing in a knot of constipation," she says. I find her story as riveting as her writing. She worked away for years on what she later realised were all the wrong sorts of things for her, books about big political events when really she was interested in things closer to home. I find her fascinating on how she kept going, even when someone told her nobody wants to read stories about people in their 40s, and how writing is learning to hear what you sound like in readers' minds. This episode of Write Off is sponsored by The Novelry. The Novelry is one of the world's best-loved writing schools, with more 5-star reviews on Trustpilot than any other. With one-to-one coaching from best-selling authors, feedback from publishing editors, and step-by-step daily lessons to create, write, and complete your book. On the Classic Storytelling Foundation course, you'll build your story idea, looking at the ingredients of the best-selling novels of all time to come up with a story that's uniquely yours. On the 90-day novel course, you'll get that first draft done fast with step-by-step daily guidance and one-to-one coaching from a published author. On the Big Edit, you'll work with a publishing editor to polish the second draft and beyond, taking the manuscript to publishing standard. The Novelry offers courses, coaching and community, a 3-pronged approach to write and finish your novel. I'd just like to add that I myself have actually just started one of their courses, and it's such a wonderful community, really fun, really engaged. I highly recommend it. Make this your year. Sign up at thenovelry.com today and discover the courses so many writers describe as life-changing. So let's listen to Tessa.
I did write lots of stories in that lovely innocence when you're not concerned with being published. I do seem to remember that weirdly the guitar player in my dad's jazz band knew some publisher and took some of my stories to the publisher, who of course refused them. You know, I mean, they were silly. They were just children's stories. There are different kinds of failure when you're a child. What I do remember is the sensation of the writing not being good enough, because I knew the excitement of reading, and I knew that whatever that chemistry was that happened on the page wasn't happening. And I've talked about this a little bit recently. I sort of suddenly clicked with me that the real source of fiction making was in the games I played with other girls, my odd little clique of friends, and that's where storytelling comes from. And that didn't feel unsatisfactory. That felt very rich and full, and we lived inside it. Whereas the words on the page, I remember a funny thing where I knew that writers wrote and then corrected and rewrote. But as a child, you don't know why you would do that. You just say something once. But I remember actually writing and then deliberately crossing out some words and putting different words, not because I really thought they were any better, but because I thought that's what you do. So those are memories from child writing. And then I stopped when I went to university, like lots of people do, and felt humbled, if not abased, and was also busy becoming a reader, a full, rich reader. So I didn't do it then. And there was some sense of being crushed, but not, I'm not complaining about it. That's exactly what one ought to feel. And then I did come back to it gradually in my 20s, really, was when I started writing again.
Okay. And I know you had your first child quite young, didn't you? I think you were 24.
Yeah.
What was that like? I think you're a teacher at this point. What was it like having children at this point, and just thinking about all that pram and the hall stuff, whether you felt in some way, you just described feeling sort of crushed. I wonder whether that felt additionally crushing in to your writing at that point, or whether you started writing and had sort of fun with it anyway.
It does feel like describing something from history now. I didn't come out from university, even though I sort of did well and was at Cambridge, but I should have had a sense of a career, an ambition. I should have thought, I'm going to be a writer or I'm going to be a journalist. I can't express to you how sort of private my ambitions were. And I think my ambitions were much more to be the writing thing was slightly in abeyance, and I wanted to have children, and I wanted that baby. And also, I had to add into the picture slightly less nobly. I was the world's worst school teacher. I was failing so miserably and discovering that it so wasn't for me. They are still my total heroes in the world, the wonderful school teachers upon whom we all rely. All of us have got teachers who've opened our eyes and our minds. It's just the best job, but I'm too lazy and too selfish, and it was too hard. So I was having the most miserable year school teaching. So even having a baby was easier than that. So even at the worst times, at 4 a.m, walking up and down with my little boy and sort of at a total loss, I would think at least it's better than teaching. So that helped. I recommend that as a sort of route into motherhood. and then the ambition to write, ambition isn't even the right word, the kind of compulsion to write just snuck back in. All my upper mind was forbidding it and thinking that, you know, only being George Eliot or T.H. Lawrence was worth it, but it just persisted. And there was a funny little thing where a friend of a friend, I mean, we didn't know writery people at all, but a friend of a friend was a school teacher, actually, and had been commissioned to write children's books. And he didn't have time or didn't want to do it. And my husband and I did it. And that really was when my first baby was small. And I snatched the time. We did research on old folktales and then retold them. These are published books. And we had two lovely books of folktales published by Cambridge University Press. Really, it was not to our credit. And when we proposed a third one, they didn't even want it. It wasn't a start to my writing career. It was almost like a freakish thing. But while we were doing those stories, I think I had one of those moments of intimation when I thought, oh, I can do this. That didn't last, but it was enough. It was I had some sense of knowing how to put words together. We were just taking a folktale and then retelling it in, I now find, slightly irritating sort of style. But anyway, that was the first. And then starting to put down little bits of the life around me, which was always what I'd wanted to read and then what I wanted to write. But then the terrible years of failing to do that, really.
Well, it's interesting that you've said, you know, the first things when you really got back into it that you started to put down were things about life around you, because I know you actually went, when you wrote these novels that sort of sat and didn't get published, they weren't about that at all, were they? These were about completely other things. Tell us a little bit about that.
Some were and some weren't. They varied in my struggles, because you're absolutely right. Somewhere I should have always known that the right subject was what's around me. And I think that I remember very, very early scraps that were about a concert I'd been to, or some people living in a flat, and they were just scraps. They weren't even stories. But then I think I was under the influence of I was reading partly under the influence of certain friends, a group of friends who rather despised, I have to say male friends, who despised the domestic and thought that was just, you know, remember one of them saying about Nadine Gordimer, even something like, who wants to read about people sweating? and they were reading political books, Brecht, lots of Brecht. He was a bit of a presiding genius. And then wonderful Turkish writer, though I haven't revisited him for a long time, Yasha Kamal, Ismail Kadari from the from Albania, isn't he? Yes, all the Balkans. Anyway, those world writers with big stories to tell of North and South, cultural clash. I mean, all the things that I'm still passionately interested in and want to read about, but like I am the least equipped person in the world to write about. So there was a sort of uneasy meeting of my reading and my writing at that point. And it was discovering a few writers that just, they were so convincing to me. Nadine Gordimer among them, although she also complicated things because she is a big world political writer. But Alice Munro, what a breakthrough. Reading people who I was so new, they were great. I didn't care what anybody else or those men who were influencing me thought. I knew she was great. And there she was writing about buying a tin of tomatoes at the shop, or you know, frosting a cake or whatever. So that there eventually came a sort of doorway into being able to write about the small things
You've been compared to Alice Munro by several people. I think Anne Enright said, two writers who would rather be wise than nice, she said.
That's such a lovely... I have this wonderful theory about being compared to people. Of course, I can't tell you how beautiful that is. I think if you mention writers enough and say to everyone, I love Alice Munro, I love Elizabeth Byrne, sooner or later someone compares you to them. It's wonderful. So seed your talk with all the writers you want to be compared to.
Okay.
I mean, I love the idea. Yeah. I mean, and it's, of course, it's more than that, because I learned to write reading Alice Munro. In fact, it's funny, I think I had a period just recently where I'd overread her. I mean, I literally know lots of the stories, not off by heart, but I know every sentence. Nothing's going to surprise me. And that's too much. You shouldn't read like that. Maybe it's all right for a bit. And I've given her a rest. I haven't read her very much. And I've just picked her up again, and it's lovely. It's all spring fresh again, and I'm loving it all over again.
Well, just going back a little bit to the ones before the Munro et al. Influences. So what were you writing about? You were being influenced by these friends and these readers with these sort of big grand geopolitical plans. What sort of books? I mean, I've interviewed you before, and I remember you talking about things like Welsh mining strikes and French anarchists. And can you tell me a little bit about those books, the ones that didn't make it?
Yeah. We moved to Cardiff, and we were there at the time of the 1984-85 miners' strike, and the whole of South Wales was very galvanised, almost wholly in support of that strike. We saw it as make or break. And I guess it was, although in retrospect, it seems, you know, deliberately promoted by the Thatcher government in order to break the unions and so on and so forth. It was a moving story, amazing story. There should be a novel of it, but of course it should be told by somebody who knows more about it than me. I didn't try to be, to my own credit, and I didn't try to write from the point of view of miners or anything like that. I probably was trying out a terrain that later I would, you know, became my terrain later. I was writing about bourgeois leftist intelligentsia in Cardiff, and I think I really can't remember it very well, but I know I had a charismatic Welsh MP who may have been loosely based on Kim Howells. I don't know if people remember Kim, but he was a bit of a leading figure in, you know, an MP, but also in the involved with the NUM at the time. So I wasn't literally describing, you know, the dirt at the coalface. I was trying to address that intersection of living politics and activism with dailiness, I suppose. And I was just failing to do that somehow. I think the failure wasn't even exactly in the subject matter. I'll come back to the French anarchists in a minute. It wasn't exactly in the subject matter. It was in a kind of nervous obedience to the subject matter. There is some gesture you have to make in writing at some point where you seize your subject and you feel you have authority over it. And that was what was lacking. I was trying to be a good girl, and I was writing dutifully about taking positions that I thought were the right positions to take. And that isn't how you produce good writing. So that's my memory of that book.
Did you know when you were writing this book and others, did you know that it wasn't very good? Were you enjoying it?
That's the $64 million question, as they say. Ah. I mean, writers probably all their lives sit there trying to work out from their own feelings whether something is good or not. And what you know is that that is so not straightforward, that you can have a brilliant day and feel you're good, but later it will turn out that was fake, that was wrong. And you can struggle and write something rather laboriously, not feeling confident about it, which turns out later to be true. But maybe deep down you have a sense that a project is alive, but so hard, because so much is invested in it, so much is invested in this novel. So I what I remember at the time is lots of doubt, much more doubt than you, it sounds like. I was full of doubt and had very little. I had ambition, I think, but it was a writerly ambition rather than a publishing ambition. I can't quite explain that. It wasn't pragmatic. I didn't even really, to be honest, know much about publishing or how to get something published. And I was haunted by a sense that it was not alive, that it was, there was something dead. And then I had a hope that all writers felt like that, and it would turn out it was all right. That's how I got back down to it every day, in the hope that although it disappointed me in some sense, it didn't fly. And yet I had a hope that that was all right. That's what everyone feels. And I think I do at least know now when something is flying, you have some sense that it has its own energy and that it lifts you up as you get the next bit and put the next bit in place, and you have a kind of joy in opening it up. So I hope that, I'm better at that.
And were you sort of doing this in secret? I mean, were you embarrassed by it in some way, or were you showing friends and your husband? Were they supportive?
No, I never showed my husband. I showed him some scrap incredibly early on, and he said something totally forbidding, like, oh, I don't think you can do that.
Oh, God.
I know. So I've never shown him anything again. He reads them when they're finished. I don't know what he thinks about them now. So that was fine. I just didn't show him. I did show them to a couple of friends. Probably when they were finished, I think, not as I was going along. And I was deeply embarrassed by it. I had to sort of fess up to it in as far as I had to do some things, like at some point when I had two babies, I did get a childminder who looked after one of my little boys some afternoons for a couple of hours so I could do some. So I sort of had to say what I was doing. But it was humiliating because I wasn't at all convinced that it would come to anything. So I talked about it as little as possible, really. I also had bits of teaching and I would use them as a kind of cover. So it was not, it wasn't a glorious, fine thing. It was a rather furtive and shaming thing. And what impelled me to keep going was much more a sense that I must than a sense of kind of, oh no, I love doing this. I must.
What does that, I know this is difficult to answer, but what do you think that means, a sense that you must? Just, does that mean that something inside you needed to come out, or?
Such a mystery, isn't it? Because why did I feel that about writing? I've often asked myself. I love paintings. I've never felt any need to paint. I just enjoy the paintings. Ditto with film. Why, when I read books, did at some very early age, why did I get inoculated with the need to make books of my own? And I can remember having that thought at, I think, 10 or 11. I remember thinking, I want to make books of my own. And I had a title, which is so funny and so prescient. I know this is true. I'm very questioning of my memories, but I know this is true. I thought, I will write a book called A Girl and Her Imagination. Isn't that amazing? And I never have. And I never will. It's not a great title, but it's a speaking phrase, isn't it? That I had something there. I knew something. So I don't know why I had to, but what I know is, and this is just as true now, in some bizarre way, I don't feel I can be properly alive in my life unless I'm making stories. When I say out of it, I don't mean out of my autobiographical experience directly, but out of my world.
Yes, making meaning. So did those books, I mean, how many do you think there were, by the way, completed manuscripts?
I think there were four.
Four.
But I can't remember what the others were. I vaguely.
Did they go off to agents?
They publishers? They went, I think a couple of them I might have sent to publishers, not knowing that you should send them to agents. And I would get one rejection letter, which I'm sure was just a standard slush pile rejection letter. And I would feel completely and utterly crushed and would never send it again. I didn't know that you were meant to send it to lots. I hadn't even got the, I must have had the writers and artists year, but mustn't I? Because I must have got the addresses from somewhere, but I obviously didn't read it very attentively. Anyway, then I did send it to an agent once. I'm sure I've told you this story before. This is a nice self-satisfied story. I sent it to an agent called Gina Pollinger, who was quite big at the time. Or maybe I sent her some of my stories. So I suspect they were a bit better already than those first novels. And she said she'd see me. And I went to London, amazing trip, and went to visit her. And I remember her funny little book piled office. So this is probably in the 1980s. I'm sure it was the 80s. And she sort of said, well, these are quite good, some of these stories, and you should send them around. It's exactly what I would say now, you know, send them into, maybe not competitions, weren't such a big thing then, but, you know, send them to magazines, which did accept stories then. And then I said, well, what magazines should I send them to? And I was at the time reading Alice Munro and Nadine Gordimer. So I said, shall I send them to The New Yorker? And then I saw her and her assistant kind of look at each other like, who does she think she is? So that's a rather lovely memory, because then I did eventually get stories into The New Yorker, like a fairy tale. But at that time, I just caught the look. Didn't know the happy ending, of course.
Yes. Yes. How amazing.
So it was there were little tiny thwarted bits of putting myself out there. But for whatever reason, possibly because somewhere I knew the books were not good enough, but I don't know whether it was quite that. I think it was that. I didn't do it properly, obviously.
Okay, so you were sort of haphazardly sending them out, and maybe that yeah. means that when you got the rejections back, that didn't hurt as much.
No, it did.
It was terrible.
Okay. It was still terrible.
Okay.
And I sort of, even though they were silly rejections, I remember my brother had a friend who was a publisher. His friend's wife I've forgotten, she had a little publishing company of her own for a while. And she wrote something interesting about one of the books, maybe the coal mining book. And she said something like, what did she say? Something like, nobody will want to read about people in their 40s.
Oh, my God.
That is right.
Oh,
wow. They're too old. But she, at the same time, she sort of said, I'm surprised no one's picked you up. And that, I think I had a real sense of that. I had a sense that there was something odd about my writing, that it was almost good. Do you know what I mean? I had a feeling that it wasn't just failing ordinarily, that it had something in it. I really think I had an intimation of that, that therefore it was failing hugely. I can't quite explain
yes.
the difference between,
but
it's not just, oh, we've seen lots of, but sort of there was something almost wrong with it because its reach was ambitious or something.
And that's what in the end has proved your, you know, the thing that you are best known for is writing about these people in their 40s and what they
yeah,
do. And actually, since
yeah.
I interviewed you last, I have turned 40. And so I feel that now I am part of this club of, oh, good, people are writing about us. But it is really interesting that that's sort of what you were, I guess, criticized for. And then that's turned out to be your sort of trademark thing.
Yeah.
So you carried on. You carried on writing, sort of submitting. And then in your late 30s, you enrolled in a creative writing
yeah.
course, I think at Bath, didn't you?
Yeah.
And that sort of changed everything for you, didn't
yeah.
it? Can you explain
really
how?
Did. Yeah. And it's why I'm a wholehearted believer in those courses, while knowing how imperfect they sometimes are, the strange ways they've changed the literary market, all of that, and how expensive they are as well, and that not everyone can do it. I still think they have democratized the world of publishing beyond belief. I do think that. A friend suggested it to me, and she actually had gone and looked at the course and then didn't get round to, or didn't, it wasn't the right moment for her. And I sort of just followed in her footsteps, and I thought, I was full of snobbishness about it. I thought, none of the writers I admire have ever been on a creative writing course. What is this silly thing? You can't teach writing. But at the same time, I thought, I kind of needed a make or break. I thought, I cannot go on doing this. It's too agonizing, just writing and failing. I'll die. Of course, I would have died. And it was marvelous for me. And you can't teach anyone to write. It didn't teach me to write. There is no toolkit. There was nothing anyone said that turned a light in my head. It was something much more intangible and wonderful than that. It was being in a community of writers who you didn't necessarily have to love what they wrote. It was just workaday for a start. I actually love being back in the world. I had been rather strangely secluded in my mothering and housewifing. Not quite as dreary as that sounds. I had lovely friends and dinner parties and party parties and all of that side of life. But still, there was something a bit odd. And I was ashamed of myself when I thought about my women friends, and especially slightly younger women friends with what careers, doing good in the world, doing stuff. I felt embarrassed by my own privacy and nothingness. So lovely to be out in the world again. Lovely actually to, the one thing I've always been hugely confident about is critical writing. I've always been a very confident critic. And so being in a university and actually doing critical reading alongside the writing stuff, I think that gave me my confidence back, and I enjoyed that so much. And I now think I'll come back to the course, but at the end of it, I still didn't really have a publishable book, and I did a PhD, a literary PhD instead, and got a job in the university teaching as much literature as creative writing at first. And I now think that that PhD, which became a book on Henry James, I think that the rehearsing of authority in those sentences, which came to me naturally, I'm not saying it wasn't hard work, but I was comfortable. That was me. That was what I sounded like. That was how I thought.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
And it was that rehearsal of authority. I didn't know this at the time, but I've worked it out since, that gave me the authority actually in my fiction. I can imagine what anathema that sounds to many writers who feel the two kinds of writing are, you know, oil and water. But that's never been like that for me. I think there's a bleeding into each other. And so that, I think, was an important part of it.
I think that makes sense. I remember when I wrote my novel, the novel that didn't end up being published, but my husband, I had just come off the back of a maternity leave, and my husband said, oh, well, just do the creative writing. Don't do anything else, because you always wanted to do this. Mm. And I said, you know what? I think I need to do a bit of journalism as well, because I feel that if I put all, it's not putting all my eggs in one basket, but I feel that the one aids the other somehow, that I'm out living and writing, and it's not, you know, that somehow that kind of selfhood and authority is revived by doing these other things.
Absolutely.
And then when I come to the writing, I have something to give it. I think it's a really interesting point. Anyway, sorry, do carry on. So you were doing your
master's. It's so nice to hear you say that, because it took me a while to see it, what was so obvious, but I think it's true. I don't think it's true for all writers, but I think it's true for you and true for me, and there are others out there. But equally, writing for the workshops, what was just so useful, partly because it takes away some of that humiliating furtiveness. You've got to do this for Thursday. It's an assignment. I have to do my work for the class. It kind of just knocks the edges off. And then something miraculous happens when, instead of an abstract audience of sort of Tolstoy, George Eliot and Brecht sitting out there thinking that sentence she's written isn't very good, you have Ron and Laurie and Debbie on Thursday, and you're writing for their ears or their eyes or their minds, and you can hear what you sound like with a new closeness and urgency. And I more and more think that learning to write is as much that as it is anything else. It's hearing what you sound like in other minds, in your readers' minds, and to their eye. And so that, it just seemed to, I could feel it lifting my sentences. It was marvelous. And also, of course, competition. Writing is competitive. The truth is, you think, am I really not as good as these? I can do better than that. And then you write better, and they're all doing the same. It wasn't horrible. It was love. We were also mutually supportive, but under that mutual supportiveness, there was also competition.
Yes.
Of course. Yeah. And that was good. And I did, it was the actual process of writing a novel, though that novel was a bit of a hybrid. I think of it all as half being like the novels that had failed before, and having in it a sort of emergent thing that probably sounded like what I then come to sound like later. It was a hybrid. It was an ugly, unborn thing, but still it was the best thing. And I had passages in it where I had felt free and authoritative.
And so this wasn't, the novel you were writing on your course was not Accidents in the Home, which was your first published novel.
No, then there's this sort of miracle where I do this PhD. I go on writing some short stories and things. I can't remember the exact timing. I get a job at the university. So remember, I am very lazy and sort of that selfish person who couldn't be a school teacher. But somehow, at the same time, I write the Henry James book. I teach full time. I actually have four kids at home because my youngest stepson came to live with us. Maybe he wasn't exactly at home all that time, but he effectively had four children at home. And I wrote Accidents in the Home. This is unimaginable to me now. I don't really work like that, but it was one of those moments in life when everything came together and the energy appeared and the stamina appeared to do that for a short while anyway. And yeah. Actually in my first year, in my first years of teaching, I wrote Accidents in the Home. Yeah.
And what did it feel like when you then got an agent and a publishing deal with Accidents in the Home? What was that like for you after all of that?
I mean, it was the huge life-transforming event of my life, really. It felt just marvellous, yeah. I mean, I think coming back to that thing of whether one knows a book is a failure, I can remember writing it. I can remember certain passages of writing. And it was as if a gate gave way and a great flood of perception that felt playful. It felt like that childhood play, as if it was bottomless. Oh my God, I know all this. I know what to put, what to see. I know what they're feeling. I know what they do, and it's wicked. Oh, and then they do that. It was this sort of flood was unleashed, and it was lovely. So I knew, while I was writing it, that I'd got to a new place that felt different. I'd probably already felt it in a few short stories, first of all. And in fact, of course, Accidents in the Home is a series of short stories that are connected together by plot, actually, by being about the same people in chronological order. But they effectively, each chapter, apart from I think the last, works as a self-contained story. So I got that sprung tension of the story. I didn't have the confidence at that point. It took me a long time for a fully proportioned novel. And then I showed it to a colleague who was himself a published writer. So this sort of thing was happening. Suddenly I knew people who were professional writers. And he showed it to his agent, Caroline Dorney, who's still my agent now. And then I met her at dinner, or perhaps I met her at dinner first, and then she took my manuscript. Still was a manuscript in those days, though written on a computer, I think. Yeah, not a typewriter, written on a computer, but printed out and given to her. And then she contacted me and said she'd like to take me on. And then she phoned me to say that Cape had bought the book. And I actually phoned my best friend, the one who has been with me on all my writing journey. And I said to her what had happened. And she said, oh, that changes everything. And it does.
Well, and she was right. And I mean, I suppose sometimes it's not, you know, sometimes it's a little dangerous for writers to think at that point that, you know, it changes absolutely everything, because for many it doesn't, and it's, you know, it carries on being a slog. But obviously, but you know, many of your books have been lauded since that very first one.
She was absolutely right. I didn't even know that. By the way, feeling that I knew what I was doing and then being published did not mean I was amazed to be reviewed. I thought I probably, because I had a realistic sense then, particularly coming off the writing course, of what most people's careers were, that, you know, you were lucky if you were published locally by a local press and so on. And I was prepared for that. I was prepared for that. And I was amazed when the book was reviewed and so on and so forth. So it wasn't that I then thought, oh, well, that's all right, I'm going to make a living as a writer or anything like that. Not at all. I was modest in my, you know, I had a modest sense of what would come. I wouldn't have imagined I would be as lucky as I have been.
That first book was actually long listed for the Guardian First Book Award, wasn't it? And I think it was accompanied by a few reviews that kind of hailed you as this very, very
Julie Myerson wrote me a most lovely review, which I will be eternally grateful for.
I'm really interested to know, just returning to that thing you said earlier about being a child and not realizing that people edited that, you know, this sort of magic that came from their imagination. Do you, and did you in that first book edit a lot? And was that, you know, you just mentioned, you know, how you felt the sort of well open up with all these things that you knew and they just sort of came. Was it a struggle then to edit those sort of magic happenings?
No, I think I've always been actually a very, very controlling writer. And I don't edit hugely in the sense that I know a lot of people write a very, very thin first draft. Lots of, like Alice Munro, I've got a feeling. I don't quite know what she does, but I am writing in a slightly constipated knot all the time, except in those wonderful moments when the gates do open. And I can remember that with a few bits of accidents in the home, but no, that is not that is by no means the whole story. Those are the little blissful passages. No, so I'm a really slow and painful writer, and all one's work, one's labour, one's ugly, fraught labour is to make the sentences read as if they flowed out from you effortlessly, but you know, under the surface, the feet are paddling away. So I do edit, and I hugely, but actually not big swathes of editing so much, although that too. But as it's written, the paragraph takes ages. And then as well, when let's say a chapter's finished or whatever, then I will also be rereading it, taking this out, putting that there, thinking there's a beat missing here. So yeah, I'm a really Freudian.
It's interesting because I have a quote here actually from the judges of the Wyndham Campbell Prize, which you won in 2016, that says, "Your writing brilliantly illuminates ordinary lives with extraordinary prose that is superbly controlled." And then it goes on to say lots of other complimentary things.
Yeah. But I
really noted that. And I was going to ask you about that anyway, this sort of controlled sense, because it doesn't feel, in your words, constipated to read. But I think it is, you know, it is a restrained kind of writing with this. And it's interesting to hear that you write it that way also.
Yeah, I do. And I'm putting a semicolon in and then I'm taking it out and putting a full stop. I mean, I now can't imagine writing on a typewriter. Of course, I would have just trained my brain differently. I would have a different technique. I'd be doing a certain amount. I'd probably be writing by hand. But I know. Did I? Yes, I did. I did. Those early novels were handwritten and then typed up because you can't make enough changes on a typewriter. But now my brain is totally adapted to the lovely fluidity of working on the screen, which is blissful to me, where you can just go on and on moving stuff and you don't end up with an unreadable blackened page of inky writing.
Yes.
That must dictate a very different mind process, but I don't think it's a bad one, or I'm sure it isn't a good one either, because all the evidence is people have written sublimely in every way. But I do love that flexibility of going on and on, changing and fiddling.
I know you said in the past it took you a while to work out what you wanted to write, not just the subject matter, but the voice. And Accidents in the Home, which we've mentioned is your first book, is very much about female yearning, as are many of your books, and particularly your latest, Free Love. And both these books feature middle-aged women who feel in some way dissatisfied, or in some cases sort of suddenly realize that they were dissatisfied when they didn't know it, and end up kind of bulldozing their lives, where there are the nice lives, to attain something quite intangible. I wanted to read a little bit from Free Love and then just talk a little bit about where this comes from, this interest of yours. This is one of my favorite passages from Free Love, which is such a wonderful book. And this is about the main character, Phyllis, who's in her home at this point with a young male guest. She'd begun joking recently about becoming an old woman. She'd pictured herself sliding across serenely into middle age, fulfilled and busy with her house and her hobbies. But all this cheerful resignation she recognised now had been a sham, mere self-deception. It hadn't seriously occurred to her in her deeper awareness that anything had changed or must ever change. She'd taken for granted that at her core, her sexual self would continue forever, a nugget of radioactive material charged with its power, irreducible. It's a lovely passage, I think, and, you know, has echoes and is echoed by many of your other works. What do you think it is about this sort of female yearning, this kind of turning point, and also the messiness of family life that interests you so much?
I mean, I guess it's just being female. It's the angle I come in at. The novel of adultery was so interesting for so long because, and I think this is actually Tony Tanner, the critic, who said this, it's expresses perfectly the tension of, if you like, bourgeois existence between the rules, the law, the contract, and feeling, subjective experience. And there's Anna Karenina exactly at the intersection between those two things. There's Emma Bovary, etc., and Gwendolyn Harlow, and so on. So, but in a way, the novel of adultery is, it's you cannot get the same energies out of it anymore, because in the end, if a woman nowadays really, really, really is unhappy with her husband, she can leave him and go off with her lovers. So it's that's changed women's writing. The old tragic pressure upon women ground in those millstones has gone because of sociology, because of change, because of historical change. So I guess that interests me. What is going to become of female sensibility with the new freedom that we have after these millennia? That's a good subject, isn't it?
Yes, it's a very good subject. And I think what is so interesting about your books is how they explore that very fine line between happiness and self-fulfillment, where they're not necessarily the same thing. And just because you can do something, is it the thing that's going to make you happy?
Yeah. That's right. And I mean, I really, really didn't mean Free Love to be a romantic story of an oppressed woman who finds freedom. It really isn't that. I'm just watching her doing what lots of women did at that particular historical moment. I actually think we're doing it less now, because I think the although I'm not telling a disenchanted story either, I also rather love her doing it. And I feel there's a huge energy around what she did. But I think now, however many years it is later, 50 years later, there is a disenchantment with that rush to freedom, that rush to self-fulfillment, which was so romantic. It was so, I mean, romantic with a capital R. I mean, like, you know, Shelley and Byron romantic. It was such a vision of total change. And then you come up against the complexities that push back against it. So that's where we are now. I don't know where I was going with that. Sorry, Francesca, but it's interesting subject about a post 1960s subject of freedom in the West.
Do you plan in your books? Were you surprised by some of the things Phyllis does?
And of course I'm surprised, and I don't, but I do plan. Free Love was like a gift. It fell in my lap. I literally have 3 pages in a notebook where I write down the whole story. Really, the whole story. Nearly all of it, including the twist. That is so not happening to me with my new novel, which I'm really struggling with. And that we haven't talked about, but I should, you know, the struggle and the horribleness and the days of despair and they just carry on. They do.
What do you do when those days come these days, when you have much practice at it?
Yeah, I am more practiced at it. So push on is the answer. Push on, try again. It is very sustaining to have written things you are pleased with. That's amazingly sustaining compared to being at the beginning. So you just think, I actually have almost come to the point where I can think, well, at least I've written those books. If I can never do it again. But then I have to think, but what will I do with my days? I have no idea. So
you might as well write.
I mean, it's more than that. It's much more than that. The question of what will I do with my days isn't calm. It's total desperation, because I still feel my happiness comes hugely from that work. So it's a problem. I think it is a problem. I don't know how long one can go on writing novels, certainly. The poets have a long, they have longevity as long as they don't drink themselves to romantic oblivion or anything. They're not that many novelists who go on writing well into their 70s, actually. I know everybody, of course, Penelope Fitzgerald, but she had such a backup of not having done it for so many years.
Yes, yes.
So,
why do you think that is then? Do you just think people get tired?
Yeah,
because
I think
it's
partly the sheer stamina of it. I think you get out of touch with what the world is somehow. I mean, I'm very grateful to have all those children because that keeps you in touch with it. But it's very interesting. My other huge star in my firmament is Elizabeth Bowen. And some of her late novels, I don't like. Maybe just one of them is not as good. That feels awkward and mannered and uncomfortable. But actually the last one, Eva Trout, is weird as weird can be. But anyway, and this is true of Elizabeth Taylor as well, writing at the same time, both of them, when they published in the 60s, were reviewed as if, what's this old stuff? You know, this tinkling of the teacups, so ladylike, when we have Jean-Paul Sartre kind of thing. We have a perspective on that now. Certainly, yes. Mike, I'd rather pick up an Elizabeth Bowen than a Jean-Paul Sartre, you know, a thousand times.
A topic that it comes up in Free Love, in fact, this pompous intellectualism.
But it is that sense that one, there might just be a slippage between your sentences, your what do I sound like, how do I see, and the world. And that is part of growing old. So
I think that's so interesting. Just going back to this idea of the domestic, just for a second, just got a couple of questions left, Tessa, and then I'll let you go. Yes, this idea of the domestic that your friend so helpfully pointed out early in your nascent career, which now, you know, you are very, very, very good at and very well known for doing very well. How do you feel about that viewpoint now? I mean, actually, you know, Free Love is sort of about women and their constraints. I wonder how you feel about this constraint for female writers that, you know, there are some things that we're supposed to be better at, and that, you know, you get this sort of women's fiction stuff, and even in literary fiction this divide still seems to exist about appropriate topics or, you know, prize giving topics and things like that.
Yeah.
Do you think that you've broken ground there a little bit, or do you think that this continues to be a problem for female writers?
I don't know. I think the problem's probably changed. I mean, in a way, I applaud the books that aren't domestic. I have no crusade to say that fiction should be this kind of representation. It is just, it's the thing I do. It's the thing I have to say. And that's not a choice. There is no choice about what you write. That's a really interesting discovery. You don't have a choice. Shall I be the kind of writer who writes about, you know, French political exiles in the 1870s? Or shall I write about, no, it isn't a choice. You just have to find the thing that is yours. So in a way, it feels to me too parochial in a sense. I think problem. It's a feature of realist fiction, which after all has only existed really in the forms we have it now, and the fineness to which it's been brought by great writers. It's really only 200 years old. You know, not fiction before that was magnificent, but different. This thing, this domestic thing, is not that old. And it is parochial in its nature. And I've always wanted that word parochial, which can be used in a derogatory sense. I really don't mean it. I mean it. I love the parish, the small, the how is it done? What did they have for tea? What did it feel like to be trapped inside that dress or that morning suit? You know, but one has to also recognize that there is a big world out there, and that there are other more drastic stories that need telling, so to speak. So where are we going? We're going with the domestic and whether it's demeaned.
Yes.
Do you
think that view of it persists in some way? I mean, there are quite a lot of readers of yours who insist that you would have won more prizes if the domestic didn't still inhabit this slightly weird place in writing.
I never even longlisted for the Booker, but I didn't even listen this year. Someone said to me after that. I said, oh no, has the list come out?
Well, I mean, lots of people think obviously that you should have been longlisted and more, and I am definitely among them. But what do you think that is?
I kind of think I think it's just awkward, and I've passed a point, and now people think, oh, she's what she is, and it's old fashioned, and I don't know. I don't care that much about that, but maybe I should care for genuinely with the readers I have. I love it. What a miracle! What a joy! I genuinely feel that. Half of the answer to your question is, at its best, my hope, my aspiration for the best kind of parochial writing is that it yearns to something other. I mean, Free Love isn't just about Phyllis's feelings. That the scene that is the crux of the book is the night when her lover, Nicky, who's a casual lefty, you know, he's a total lefty, he's a totally radical young man, but one knows he'll sort of, he's going to be a publisher when he grows up. I know that. Anyway, he's there, and he's sort of given her the small change of critique. The Vietnam War is filthy. The men who control the world and think they're so sane and right. The world is insane, and it's cruel, and it's brutal. And for him, it's commonplace. And she sits up, this very ordinary, non-intellectual, not very educated, perhaps even in some ways not very intelligent, although intelligence, what is that? She sits up for an hour or two in the cold on her own. He falls asleep. And she lets that new thought and way of seeing the world inside her. And she thinks about the telly reports on the Vietnam War that she's watched. And she thinks, I trusted the men. I can remember this as a child thinking, oh, well, but the nice man telling the story knows that it's all right. I remember thinking that, and that's what she's thought is a 40-year-old, which is a bit, you know, she's been silly. And she wakes up, and I do want to always have, and I think the best domestic fiction always aspires to this, have the world pushing in on that not safe domestic space, which is fragile and provisional and flawed.
Yes, and I think the book does that very well. And I think all your books, even with their less obvious sort of geopolitical issues, also do that. They're not existing in this sort of microcosm. They, you know, it's...
Okay, well, that's lovely to hear you say that.
What do you think is really important for writers to know in order to improve? Because you spent a long time doing it. You've talked about the difference between these sort of, I think you've called them bad books before, and then, you know, and then this... this one that broke out, Accidents in the Home. What do you think writers should learn in order to get better?
It's probably every case is its own story. I think that's what I learned from teaching students for years, teaching, supervising different novels at Bath Spa. Each novel is its own problem and has its own solutions. Each writer is her or his own problem, has her or his own solutions. I mean, perseverance, reading, finding what, when I said there is no choice, you don't choose what to write, finding what you must write, finding the right terrain, finding the good story. I'm kind of old fashioned in that I'm not plotty at all. Like, you know, it's not that kind of plot, but a good story. And that means not just a good premise, because everybody can find a good premise, but the good follow through and a good developments, and then a good place to bring your story down. You may not have all that in place when you start, but that's the thing to aim for. And then when that story sets your mind on fire, the gates will open, and the stuff you already know about it without knowing you know it will flow through.
If you enjoyed Write Off, please do share it with others, and please, please, please consider leaving a review on the iTunes app, which really helps other people find the podcast. Do come find me to chat on Twitter, where I'm at Francesca Steele, and Instagram, where I'm at Francesca Steele Writes. I'll put that in the show notes. Thanks, and see you next time.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.